from pop culture to politics, this is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. It is a great day when everything is coming into focus. And I mean everything. The very essence of our political struggle right at the moment, that with the House passing a bill for D.C. statehood, but not with anywhere near enough of a margin for it to go forward meaningfully. We will get to that. But that is part of what is coming into focus. What's coming into focus to me is the fact that both major parties don't have a range of issues that they're talking to the people about. They don't have a range of goals on their agenda. It's just one thing for each party. And it's not the same thing. In the Democratic Party, everything. D.C. statehood, the national budget, spending programs, even climate change. It's all about race. Everything is race. Everything is about trying to seek what people call social justice, racial equity, basically erasing the devastating impact of slavery. That's one of the reasons they're giving priority to reparations right now, despite the lack of public support, because this is the one issue for Democrats. For Republicans, the one issue is not opposing racial equity. I think that every single Republican that I know, I mean, all across the board, is in favor of trying to equalize opportunity in this country and trying to open this country up, is opposed to racism or discrimination or basically oppression of any kind. But for Republicans, the number one issue isn't that. It's law and order. It's basically dealing with the feeling that everything is breaking down, that crime is running rampant among us, that things are going nuts, and that the other side is obsessed on their one issue. We're obsessed on our one issue. So where do you meet? 1-800-955-1776. We're going to be talking, you would think we could meet, on the Derek Chauvin verdict. Derek Chauvin, by the way, now in solitary confinement for 23 hours of all 24 hours a day. And he's going to be there for a very long time, especially in view of the likelihood of a federal trial where he will be tried on civil rights charges, that coming up. We'll be speaking about all of that later this hour with Andy McCarthy, Andrew McCarthy, former federal prosecutor, senior editor of National Review, on what next on the Chauvin case. There's also all kinds of new detail that actually, for such a sad and tragic case, the case of Micaiah Bryant, the 16-year-old who was killed in Columbus, Ohio. What is amazing to me, and it's very difficult to find anything encouraging about such a horrible outcome, a 16-year-old girl shot by an officer who appears to have been doing his job. What's amazing to me is that there are people coming forward, including LeBron James, who are saying, you know what, our initial instinct may have been wrong on this one. The behavior of the officer involved in this case may have been, Nicholas Reardon, his name is, may have been entirely justified. And in fact, I think it is. And some of the media coverage is encouraging for people who want to believe that it should be possible, for people who talk about the news and report the news and cover the news, to actually do a fair and honest job. Well, what about that honest job on the question of a D.C. statehood? The statement by Jen Psaki, the president's press spokesman, she's a presidential press secretary, she was at a White House press briefing today, and here is what she had to say when asked about the D.C. statehood issue. Listen.
The House today passed a bill to make Washington, D.C. the 51st state. It obviously faces some tough odds in the Senate. What's the White House's take on that, and to what extent is President Biden involved in that going forward?
Well, President Biden strongly supports D.C. statehood, and our administration will work with Congress to get it passed. We put out a statement of administration policy in strong support of H.R. 51 just this morning. His view is that the denial of voting representation in Congress and local self-government to the 712,000 residents of our nation's capital violates two of our nation's founding principles: no taxation without representation and consent of the governed. And he will continue to advocate for this passing.
Okay, the idea that it violates the principles of no taxation without representation. Most of the taxation that is taken out of the District of Columbia goes right back into the District of Columbia and more. And when you talk about no representation, they have representation. They elect their own city government. So the only difference here would be adding one member of the House and two members of the Senate. It's all about power. It's not about founding principles. And the whole idea that they are pushing with this when they know it can't go, first of all, it's going to require a constitutional amendment, because this is a violation of the terms of the Constitution, as the Wall Street Journal points out today, and it's a violation of the 23rd Amendment. The 23rd Amendment is where they decided some 60 years ago that they were going to give the District of Columbia a say in presidential elections. People in the District of Columbia get three electoral votes. So they are certainly represented in the choice of president of the United States, even though there's never really been much of a contest with the District of Columbia. Even the two presidential elections that were nearly unanimous in 1972 with Richard Nixon, where he carried every single state except for Massachusetts and the District of Columbia, and then Ronald Reagan in 1984, Ronald Reagan, 12 years later, he carried every single state except for Minnesota to the late Walter Mondale and the District of Columbia. The entire idea that this is somehow a vital issue right now, it has everything to do with the Democratic obsession with race. And it's even outdated in that regard. Once upon a time, the District of Columbia had a black majority. It doesn't anymore. Why not? Because a great deal of Washington, D.C. has been gentrified. And basically, a lot of people who used to live in the District of Columbia have moved ahead financially and have moved out. And I'm talking about black people who have moved out to the Maryland suburbs and elsewhere. In any event, the Wall Street Journal today says, fashioning an independent seat of government in a federal system while affording representation to its residents is a dilemma dating to the founding of our country. The framers of the Constitution provided in the Constitution's Article 1 that Congress could, by cession of particular states, control a small area in which the federal government would operate. In 1790, part of the territories of Virginia and Maryland, two of the 13 states that ratified the Constitution, were delineated for federal control. That's how we got a District of Columbia. The national remedy, says the Journal, for the imperfect status quo, if representation is the real concern, would be for Congress to do something it has done before: return part of the District of Columbia to the state that ceded it in the first place. That's what happened in 1846. When Congress reinstated Virginia's control over the D.C. suburbs of Arlington and Alexandria. In other words, Arlington and Alexandria used to be part of this federal district that was supposed to be the seat of government. But then they decided, because government was relatively small and there were very few people who lived in the District of Columbia, that they might as well give these villages, and they were both villages at the time, back to the state of Virginia. So what they can do is take some of the areas that are purely residential of the District of Columbia and give them back to Virginia and Maryland, if it's that important that people vote for the Senate and the House. We will be back.
Michael Medved Show. MichaelMedved.com.
And on the Michael Medved Show, talking today about the Great Divide, the idea that for Republicans, I think it's fair to say that there is a general sense that unless we establish greater public safety, unless we turn back the rise in crime and violence and disorder and property destruction, that you can't really face other issues. It's so basic. And for Democrats, they believe the same thing about the issue of what they call social justice, racial equity, that you can't go on to anything else, not the economy, not even climate change, until you deal with this race issue first. That's why they find a racial component to everything. One of the things you hear from the left is that the whatever it is, whether it's COVID or the climate or anything else, that it falls particularly onerously on people of color in this country and around the world, frankly. And by the way, that's not entirely wrong, but the emphasis, it seems to me, is wrong, because the emphasis on either side has to be, look, there are a lot of issues facing us, and it's not all about, are you for racial equality, are you against it, or are you for law and order, or are you against it? By the way, if it ends up being the kind of conversation that it looks like it's going to be in 2022 in the next election, look for a Republican landslide. I mean, look for it, because I've seen this movie before. When did I see it? Oh, between 1968 and 1976. Yeah, back then, it was the same kind of thing. The people who voted for Richard Nixon and George Wallace, by the way, were, yes, not entirely opposed to the idea of racial justice in any sense. They just emphasized this idea of law and order. And people look back at that election of 1968. When you look at that election, it was over 60% of everybody who voted for either Nixon or Wallace, who voted for so-called law and order candidates. And frankly, if the Democrats continue to be the party, as talked about in a piece in National Review today, that the Democrats want to be the party of let the kids have their knife fight, that's probably not going to work as an electoral strategy. 1-800-955-1776. Mitch McConnell is an institutionalist. He's somebody who cares deeply about the institution of the Senate. And right now, he's speaking as effectively as he can against what he perceives, and I think accurately so, as an attempt to use this brief moment of a divided government, and it is still divided government. The Senate is evenly divided, 50-50. It's only Kamala Harris's extra vote that gives the Democrats the at least thinnest possible majority, and a very thin majority in the House of Representatives. But they're attempting to use this to make sweeping institutional change. And Mitch McConnell doesn't like it. He had this to say on the Senate floor. Listen.
The American people can see right through this. Nobody's fooled. Nobody's fooled by their desperation to rewrite 50 states' election laws, or the campaign to pack the Supreme Court, or the attempt to pack the Senate with new blue states. Rewriting the rules of American politics to exclusively benefit one side, their side. That was Democrats' false charge in Georgia, but it's exactly what they're trying to do in this capital on a national scale.
Is that unfair? Does someone think that's unfair? 1-800-955-1776. Why else would they bring all this up right now, attempting to overturn a state election laws? when even, I mean, there's some actual pretty good and surprisingly fair reporting about this in the New York Times, where it talks about disagreements emerge among the Republicans pushing voting limits. And they're not voting limits. It's just an example of how some of the less effective and less defensible voting reforms that they were talking about in Arizona, they didn't need the Democrats to defeat it. It was actually Republicans themselves saying, but pull that back. That's not really a good idea. Talking about limitations, new limitations on some popular features, which include the ability to vote by mail if you want to. And the idea that right now the Democrats are trying to take this all out of the hands of the states and put it in the hands of the Congress of the United States, that's as terrible an idea as the idea that some Republicans on the state level have been launching, which is the idea to take elections out of the supervision and put them under the direct supervision of the state legislatures. And that's a terrible idea for several reasons. One is that not every state legislature has a permanent Republican majority. In fact, there are very few of them that do. Ted Cruz did a press conference on the question of D.C. statehood and also of the Supreme Court expansion, the court packing. Here's what the senator from Texas had to say.
What Senate Democrats and House Democrats are trying to do is fundamentally corrupt. Their first priority is to change the rules to stay in power. Now, that tells you a lot of things. It tells you, number one, they don't believe in democracy. They don't believe in the voters. If they want to stay in power, there's a real simple path to that. Convince the voters your ideas are right. But that's too complicated. Sometimes the voters disagree. So what are Senate Democrats trying to do? They're trying to add new senators to the Senate so they keep control forever. They're trying to change voting in America so Democrats can never lose. And they want to pack the U.S. Supreme Court with four left-wing radicals. This is an assault fundamentally on the independence of the judiciary.
Okay, it is an assault on the independence of the judiciary. And what's peculiar about it is if you look at the history of the Supreme Court, most of the truly epic-making decisions by the Supreme Court over the last 60 years have been liberal decisions. It is because of the Supreme Court that we rewrote the rules of marriage. That wasn't a decision of the voters, though they were leaning in that direction. The decisions about race and about integration and about voting rights have been made by the Supreme Court. Where are the outrageous conservative decisions that they're trying to overturn? And what about the decision yesterday that shook the whole world? The decision involving Derek Chauvin. We'll speak about that with Andy McCarthy, former federal prosecutor, and what happens next in the Medved Show. And on the Michael Medved Show, of course, Derek Chauvin, as the whole world knows, was led away in handcuffs. He is now being held in a solitary confinement, 23 hours a day in isolation. He gets 1 hour a day to exercise, but he's kept away from other prisoners. That, we're told by the authorities in Minnesota, is for his own protection. And for our protection from making any errors or missteps at all in trying to cover this very significant legal proceeding that just concluded in Minnesota, it's a pleasure to welcome Andy McCarthy back to the show. Andrew McCarthy is a former federal prosecutor. He's a best-selling author, a contributing editor at National Review, and I have found his dispatches from the court, from the trial directly, to be indispensable. Andy, thanks for joining us again.
Michael, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Okay. Right now, there's a bunch of news coverage on the way teachers are handling this trial, because the assumption is that everybody, and in Philadelphia, they even have a directive that they have to talk about it starting at kindergarten. If you were in the classroom, what would you emphasize in terms of trying to explain what just went on? What would you emphasize to your students?
I think first I'd try to correct the misinformation that's become conventional wisdom. So there's not a scintilla of evidence in the case that Chauvin was racist or that what he did here was racially motivated. And that's not me saying so. That's simply the way the evidence came out. The prosecutors never suggested that this was a racially motivated attack. They didn't say he was a racist cop. They said he was a bad cop. And there was a lot of evidence that he performed irresponsibly and worse in the critical moments of this case. But racism is not the explanation for it, even though it's the narrative about it. And then just other things, Michael, that are very commonly thought and are simply not true. I think most people that you ask about this case would tell you that Chauvin choked Floyd to death, and that simply didn't happen. The prosecution's evidence now, this is not just a defense claim, is that Floyd was never choked. His front air passages were never, there was no effort to constrict them by the police. He was subjected for an unduly long time to a pressure hold on his his lower neck and his back, which had the consequence, when you think of the reactive pressure from the hard asphalt ground, of constricting his ability to expand his lungs to breathe. And his breath ultimately became shallow, and he couldn't oxygenate the blood flow as you need in the human system, and as a result, his heart and brain and lungs failed. So that's what happened, and I think it would be helpful if most people understood those basic facts about the case. I understand why, you know, the people who are peddling the narrative don't want those facts to be known, but those are the facts.
And very important facts to embrace. I did a whole couple of shows on the missing ingredient in the prosecution. And the missing word, the word that wasn't mentioned, was race or racist at all, because they didn't need to. And by the same token, they didn't need to show that George Floyd was choked to death, because intent wasn't the issue here. Do you think this verdict can be successfully appealed?
I think it's highly unlikely, but it's a much more colorable due process claim than I can remember seeing in another case. And it's not just because, you know, Maxine Waters decided to be Maxine Waters and said the kind of irresponsible thing you'd expect her to say. You have a record here where the defendant plausibly claimed that he couldn't get a fair trial in Hennepin County from the beginning. The judge acknowledged that that was a problem, but said he would cure it by having an exacting jury selection process. While that process was going on, the city of Minneapolis, which is the jurisdiction that is constitutionally obliged to give Chauvin a fair trial, publicly announces that they've made a $27 million settlement with Floyd, which is as good as branding Chauvin guilty as charged. And then a week ago, when the awful tragedy in Brooklyn Center happened, the defense pleaded with the judge to sequester the jury, and there was no good reason not to do it, because they were at the very end of the evidence, and the jury was going to be sequestered when deliberation started anyway. So the judge could have went right into closing statements and jury instructions and then deliberations. And instead, he sent them home for a long weekend with Friday off, knowing that they were going to marinate in the rioting and the intense press coverage that we had over the weekend. And I think it's very interesting, Michael, that he gave the lawyers Friday off because the case was so complex, because there was such technical medical evidence and voluminous evidence of police manuals about use of force and the like, that he thought they needed an extra day to prepare their summations. Yet the jury came in less than a day and never gave a single note to the court. No request for testimony, no request for clarification about the law, no request to examine any of the exhibits, nothing. So, you know, you have to wonder, under all the circumstances, was there such pervasive prejudice that the reason they came in so quickly is that they felt that there was no other verdict they could render other than a guilty verdict. Doesn't mean that that's what happened, but it certainly gets them in the ballpark in a way I think most defendants aren't who raise this claim.
Andrew, very quickly, with the limited time we have left, there is a great speculation based upon some testimony at this trial that there is an ongoing federal investigation with a grand jury that that Officer Chauvin will probably be indicted and stand trial again on federal civil rights issues. You think that's a good thing?
No, I think it would be a real mistake. Those civil rights cases are not normally pursued if the defendant is convicted at the state level. A lot of people don't think they should be pursued if he's acquitted either. But, you know, he's already been convicted. He's looking at a potential 40-year sentence. And what are we to make of it if a federal grand jury, on a much tougher proof, a civil rights felony, what if they acquit him? I mean, I don't know that that's the legacy you want to have here. So I certainly wouldn't do it. I think it's a waste of time.
Andrew McCarthy, your perspective always very much appreciated. What about the idea of keeping Chauvin in solitary confinement? Do you think that's going to be the rest of the way he serves his sentence?
Well, I hope not, but it's very difficult to see how he could be in a general population situation anytime soon. It's a very, very tough thing when you have a defendant like this who obviously has to be incarcerated, but for his own good can't be incarcerated in general population. Very, very tough.
Absolutely, as the entire case was tough because the details were so gruesome and so sad and so horrifying. Andrew McCarthy, you can read his material on this case, which is the most insightful and informative material out there. It's a lot of it's posted right at michaelmedved.com. He is a contributing editor at National Review and a fellow at National Review Institute. He's also a Fox News contributor and a former chief assistant U.S. attorney. We will be right back on the Michael Medved Show in the latest on the Let Teenagers Knife Fight Caucus, coming up.
The Michael Medved Show, michaelmedved.com.
On the Michael Medved Show, obviously, when it comes to the theme that I'm trying to pursue on this show, and by the way, if you disagree with me, you are certainly encouraged to call up at any time you choose, 1-800-955-1776. The theme is that basically the big arguments that we're going to be hearing about in the election of 2022 are arguments that Karl Rove stipulates, and he's exactly right, will end up favoring the Republicans. They are arguments, on the one hand, the pursuit of what the Democrats call social justice and trying to erase age-old inequalities and to try to make up for some of the unquestioned, and it's real, history of racism in this country, and the Republicans giving priority to law and order, protecting businesses from violent riots. There's right now all kinds of Democratic criticism of anti-riot bills in Florida and Oklahoma and Indiana and elsewhere that Republican legislators are putting forward to make sure that cities in those states don't become the next Portland, Oregon, which seems to me to be a worthy goal. There is also this aspect. There's a very entertaining piece, actually, in National Review today. And it's by Philip Klein. And there's a picture of Valerie Jarrett. And Valerie Jarrett sent out a truly dubious, massively dubious piece on Twitter regarding Micaiah Bryant. She is the young girl, 16 years old, who a video very clearly shows was about to knife another black young woman. And a police officer arrived just in time to shoot her and to protect that other black young woman from being killed. And what's interesting is the piece in National Review is called The Let Teenagers Knife Fight Caucus. And he writes, before many details were known about the shooting of teenager Micaiah Bryant in Columbus, Ohio, many journalists, activists, and politicians raced to fit the story into the broader narrative about police misconduct toward black Americans. The fact that a cop shot a black teenager just as the judge was about to read the verdict in the Derek Chauvin trial made the story just too difficult to resist. When it turned out that body cam footage showed that Bryant was shot while literally lunging with a giant knife, well, it wasn't a giant knife, but it was certainly big enough to kill somebody, toward another black teenager, the story obviously changed dramatically. The Washington Post's Radley Balko showed integrity. There's something. By retracting his initial comments about the incident and apologizing for not waiting until more was known. You know who did the same thing? LeBron James. We'll get to that in a moment. On the other hand, Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown plowed ahead with the narrative, tweeting, while the verdict was being read in the Derek Chauvin trial, Columbus police shot and killed a 16-year-old girl. Her name was Micaiah Bryant. She should be alive now. And given the fact that the police had been called, they have the 911 call. And the 911 call reports that there are grown girls, that's the term that they use, who are trying to stab us here. They have knives. And the exact text of the call, these grown girls over here trying to fight us, trying to stab us. Okay, so when a police officer arrives and he sees Micaiah Bryant lunging toward another girl who presumably was part of the faction that had called the police in the first place, what is he supposed to do? And the idea, what did Valerie Jarrett say that was so offbeat? Valerie Jarrett, of course, is just not an ordinary Twitter participant. She is a former chief aide to Barack Obama. She was one of his primary political advisors and a White House aide. She still is very highly wired and thought of and an influential member of the Democratic Party. And what Valerie Jarrett said in her now notorious tweet was a black teenage girl named Micaiah Bryant was killed because a police officer immediately decided to shoot her multiple times in order to break up a knife fight, demand accountability, fight for justice, hashtag Black Lives Matter. Okay, there are people now, and by the way, Brandy Cruz, who's was a colleague over here in Seattle journalism, as she's now, I think, on Channel 13 it is, but Brandy did a very fine tweet very quickly in response to Valerie Jarrett. She said, is it a knife fight when only one person has a knife? I thought that was attempted murder. And that is a good point. When you watch this video, which is about as clear as it could be, you can see that this is not a knife fight. The other girl isn't resisting. She's just being pushed up against a car, and Micaiah Bryant is coming right at her. Now, again, it's a tragedy when a 16-year-old dies, but there are obviously tragic and complicated circumstances here. And one of the things that's fascinating is when you actually look at the way that media were covering this case, there are all kinds of people who you wouldn't expect it to be as reasonable as they were, who may have surprised us, including Chris Cuomo and Don Lemon on CNN. Listen to the way that Cuomo led the broadcast of talking about Micaiah Bryant. This is 10A.
So Don and I heard about this story last night on social media while we were doing coverage for you of the Chauvin verdict last night. And the initial reports didn't seem right. And it was so interesting for me, as emotional and personal as these stories are to someone of color, especially Don, you with your background, you were cautious about it. You were saying, I want to see this one. I want to see this. Because there was a lot of emotion, and understandably so. You got a 16-year-old kid that's gone.
Yeah.
And it's a hard one. I do not know how to explain this to people in a way that doesn't make somebody very angry.
Okay, and then Don Lemon added this.
Well, yes, and we're dealing with a lot of emotion right now, and I'm going to talk about that in a moment, and I think that is, it's real. And you have to take that, that part has to be taken into account. There's a lot of anguish. People are very emotional right now, but we've got to be fair about what happens when police arrive at scenes. It is tragic that it's a 16-year-old girl, just as it is tragic that it's a 13-year-old in Chicago. When police are chasing people, they don't know how old they are. And they don't run and say, hey, how old are you? Oh, I'm 13. You know, my mom let me, you don't know that. Or I'm 16. When they roll up on a scene, they see people tussling around. Someone has a knife. And their job is to protect and serve every life on that scene. And if they see someone who is in the process of taking a life, what is that decision? What decision do they have to make? And I know that people say, well, you know, you could do this, you could do that. Tasers don't work the way guns work.
Not at that distance. And not with that amount of time.
Tasers, then they don't always connect. So you've got to get, you know, two prongs or what have you, and it's got to connect or whatever.
Okay, good for them. And there are other issues about one of the networks, network happens to be NBC, that actually edited, crucially, the 911 call to distort the reportage of the Micaiah Bryant case. We'll also get to the apology, semi-apology, and the retraction of what LeBron James had tweeted yesterday. LeBron James, one of the greatest athletes in American history, I mean, in terms of his dominance in the game of basketball, LeBron James, King James, had tweeted out yesterday a what seemed to be a threatening note on against the police officer involved under your next hashtag accountability. That's what he sent to Officer Nicholas Reardon. Well, he thought better of it. He took down that tweet and replaced it with two others that are much more reasonable. We will get to that. We'll also talk about the far left agenda on Earth Day coming up. And more in terms of what is systemic and what is not. And anti-riot legislation, is it worth supporting? That and much more in this greatest nation on God's green earth.